Hello, and welcome to Season 4 of the Dialogue on Dialogue podcast. I'm your host, Phil Reject. This season, you'll hear from some amazing speakers giving prepared speeches, and then we'll talk about what it is that makes a speech great. And all of this isn't an effort to make the world a better place, one conversation at a time. Hello, and welcome to the Dialogue on Dialogue podcast. I'm your host, Phil Reject. And once again, I am attempting to make the world a better place, one conversation at a time. And today I am thrilled to welcome Keith Kaminsky, who was another participant in the Tall Tale contest at the District 35 speaking contest last spring. So with that, we'll get to meet Keith and we'll get to hear about how his speech came together in just a minute. But I am going to go ahead and play his contest speech, and then we will jump in to the conversation.
Keith, a handful of dirt. A handful of dirt. Keith Kaminsky. What impact can a small handful of dirt have? Mr. Contest Master, fellow Toastmasters, guests, several months ago, my interest in family history led me to a small church in Ireland, where I was assisted by one Father Murphy. Father Murphy and I were looking through the records. We found the death record in 1870 of a John Kaminsky, who I knew to be my great, great, great grandfather. Alas, my son, I can't help you. It says here in the records, non-Christian burial. Although perhaps you might try talking to one of our parishioners, Tommy Kaminsky. His family has lived in these parts for many years. So I walked the several miles down the country road to the quaint thatched roof cottage of Tommy Kaminsky. Now, Tommy knew I was coming because Father had called him in advance, and he greeted me with, "'Tis yourself indeed, and you look like a Kaminsky. Join me here for a nip of the Ishkabah." Well, it was 10 o'clock in the morning, but I felt compelled. We started comparing notes, and it turned out Tommy was my father's third cousin. I asked him, did he have any understanding at all of this strange inscription in the church records? He thought for a minute and said, "I will tell you what I know from what has been passed on to me through the ages. You see, in those days, there was a famine in the land, and millions either starved or left Ireland. And when John's youngest son, Hugh, left for America, he was heartbroken because he knew he would never see him again. Well, John took to the drink and cattle rustling, and it was for this reason that he wasn't buried in the Christian cemetery, but instead on the family property. And Tommy asked, would I be interested in seeing in the grave? Well, of course I was. And he took me to a very rough stone over which no grass was growing. And Tommy explained to me that, as far as he knew, no grass had ever grown over this grave. I was about to leave when Tommy bent down, scooped up a handful of dirt, put it in a pouch and handed it to me and said, "You take this and you remember from where your fathers have come." Well, it was about a week later, I did in fact go home. And as I flew into the airport in O'Hare and started driving north to Milwaukee, it occurred to me that my great-great-grandfather Hugh was buried in Kenosha. And something compelled me to go pay a visit. So I did. Now, I had been there several times before, but this time was a little bit different. And I noticed over the grave, a small patch over where his heart would have been was bare. And I saw the lawn keeper and I asked, "Can you explain to me why there's no grass growing over this?" It's a great question. He said, I've been working here for 25 years, and we've never been able to get grass to grow. It was at that time that I thought, I remember that pouch of dirt that Tommy had given me. So I took the dirt and I sprinkled it over the bare patch as if to say, there, I brought some of your home back to you. Several months later, my travels took me back to Kenosha, and I once again paid a visit to the cemetery and the grave of my great-great-grandfather. But this time, as I entered the cemetery, the lawn keeper saw me and came running up to me and he said, I was hoping you would come back. There's something you need to see. And he took me to the grave. He said, ever since you left, the grass has been growing like crazy. We can't explain it. We have to cut the grass every other day. It's some kind of miracle. And at that moment, my cell phone rang. And it was Tommy Comiskey calling from Ireland. Keith, I've been wanting to call you and tell you, ever since you left, about a week after, grass just started growing up over that cemetery, over the grave, where no grass had grown for over 150 years. I can't explain it, but I thought you'd want to know. And so then, for the first time in 150 years, father and son were once again reunited. It was all because of a small handful of dirt. Mr. Contest Master.
All right. Well, with that, I want to welcome Keith on to this podcast. So, Keith, if you want to turn on your camera, we can chat a little bit. Keith, hello. Welcome and thank you for participating in this. Before we get into talking about that terrific tall tale that you shared, why don't you just tell us a little bit about you know who you are and tell us about, you know, how long you've been in Toastmasters and where your club is and so forth.
Sure. Yeah. So for this contest, I was representing Rockwell Automation AB Toastmasters, where I've been a member for just under 27 years now.
Okay.
And I've served in district leadership roles up to and including district director in 2017 to 2018.
Okay.
So about 6 years ago. And so for that reason, I hadn't been able to compete in speech contests for many years. That's, you're not allowed to do that when you're a district officer. So given the opportunity, I thought, well, let's have some fun with this.
Very good. And so it's probably safe to say that you are a distinguished Toastmaster at this point.
Yes, I am.
All right. Well, for those of you who don't know, Distinguished Toastmaster is the highest honor that you can achieve, at least as far as I know, in Toastmasters. It's kind of the black belt, I guess I should say, in terms of the Toastmasters world. It's not a simple process. It takes many years. And I think because of the switchover of the pathways, I'm about 10 years into Toastmasters, but I got so far in terms of the old system and now I'm starting over, but it's all about the journey anyway for me. But congratulations on that distinguishment as well. With that, we'll just jump into the speech. I've got a few thoughts on it, but take us back. You know, what's probably what, December, maybe January, your club is putting out okay, let's start talking about the contest. And you thought, okay, well, I might have a yarn I can spin. How did you come about to decide you wanted to do the Tall Tales contest? And what were the first inklings of this speech for you?
Well, there are elements of that speech which are true. And so really the genesis, the kernel, if you will, of the idea came from the fact that I had in fact been in Ireland in the previous August, and I'd been there before, and I do genealogy research.
Okay.
And I was in the area where my ancestors are from. So, there were parts of it that were true. And, if you go to Ireland for 10 days with with one of your sons and two of his buddies, you're just, you come back with so many stories. And I thought, you know, being a longtime Toastmaster, your brain just kind of goes there, you know, all these great experiences. There's a speech here, the speech here, a speech here, a speech here. Okay. So, So we were doing Tall Tales, you know, last year. And I thought, oh, I wonder if I could do something with one of those stories or parts of one of those stories. So, that's kind of how it started.
And if I may ask, what, you know, how much did you go to the family gravesite, or much of it is true?
Well, my great, great, great grandfather's name is John. His son's name is Hugh. He is buried in Kenosha.
Okay.
And what else is true? I did talk to a gentleman named Tommy, but outside of that,
okay,
it was a tall tale.
Okay, well, excellent. One of the things that I really appreciated about your speech was your calm demeanor. I've done a tall tale contest, you know, years back, and I think because at least when I was relatively new to Toastmasters, but I thought tall tale, I have to be all jacked up and just bouncing over and over exuberant in this speech. But I really appreciated, and it lent itself well to your speech, but your relaxed just presence on the stage. I don't know if you want to say anything about that in terms of that was planned or if that was just how you naturally give your speeches, but I really appreciated that for this particular speech.
I'm not naturally calm. No, I mean, it's like a lot of people, I'm still nervous when I'm speaking in front of a crowd, and I've spoken in front of audiences as large as, you know, 400 to 500 people. I'm still nervous. Yeah. All right. So it's just a lot of practice, a lot of focus. And one of the reasons I wanted to kind of keep it on a more conversational level was because I wanted it to seem as if I was telling a story that just happened to kind of turn into a tall tale towards the end. Yeah. And I wanted to leave people with that impression that they were thinking all the way through, wait, is this true? Yep. Could this, you know, yep. You know, and like your questions right from the beginning, you know, what parts of that were true? Right. You know, was any of it true? Yeah. So I purposely wanted to do that.
Well, it came through really well. And, the other thing that I really like about, well, let me back up on one of the things that you just said. And you mentioned that you still get nervous walking on. And I think that's so important, especially for our new members to hear, because our club, the Heart of Eau Claire, has, I don't know, we've gotten maybe 5 or 6 new members in the last year. So it's just, which is just great for our club. That's a huge win. But they all see, we have some really experienced Toastmasters in our club. They see us get up there and give our speeches, and they just can't imagine being in that place. But like you said, nights before, if I said I'm going to give a speech and it's 2 days out and I haven't started it, yeah, I'm going to start getting anxious. So I think it's an important message for people to hear that you're going to be who you're going to be when you're on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, my message that I pass on to newer members, that it, you know, they say the same kind of thing. Oh, you've been in Toastmasters for so long. You appear very calm and almost dignified. I've heard that term used at times. That you should have saw me 27 years ago.
Right.
You know,
right.
I was a wreck, just like a lot of people when they start Toastmasters. And my message there is it does take some work. It takes practice. There's not a magic pill. You just have to do it.
Yeah, actually, and this is like I said, this is my third one of these interviews that I've done with people who were competing. And after listening to the first one, which I didn't prepare well enough for, it was, you know, my filler words were, I was embarrassed to listen to myself. So I actually have in my questions, slow down, look at the camera, breathe, speak clearly, just little cues that even help me remember what it is I'm doing instead of just flying off the handle here.
Yeah, I'll add to this too. You know, this was a hybrid, or hybrid's not the right word. Yeah, maybe it was. I mean, it was optional, right? It was optional for us if we wanted to deliver the speech in person or if we wanted to deliver it virtually. Given the opportunity, I will always take the in person. Mm-hmm. And that might seem counterintuitive. You know, well, okay, Keith, if you're nervous in front of crowds, wouldn't you feel more comfortable just, you know, sitting in your bedroom delivering a speech with a virtual background? No, actually, I don't. I do feed off of the energy and being able to make eye contact and watch the audience. That's really important to me. So, if you think you're nervous in front of crowds, don't look at it that way. Look at these are people that want you to do well.
And, absolutely.
And I think you don't really get that so much when you're in a virtual environment. You don't know what's out there.
I agree. And I'm assuming, like me for my speech, your first two or three contests were all virtual. So when I competed, it was virtual because I was traveling at the time. So I was grateful that I was still able to compete. But with that said, to that same point, I had gotten critiqued in the past on prior contests because I didn't know if I used humor, how long to pause or how that delivery lands with the audience. And it really is difficult for an audience member sometimes to really follow along in that regard. So, but on the flip side, let's move on to this because you also do an excellent job with gestures. So thinking about that, thinking about your gestures for your speech, how planned out or specific are you when you're giving a speech or giving this particular speech in terms of the gestures you used? Say, from the prior contest, if I were to have seen it, would the motions and gestures been more or less the same, or are you naturally just following along where the story goes?
It was definitely scripted. You know, mm-hmm. my placement on the stage, hand gestures, for example, you know, the father was heartbroken, you know, and like, okay, how do you demonstrate that in here? I mean, maybe you can see my hands, but mm-hmm. right. He was heartbroken, but that will have an impact if you saw me on stage, which, you know, you were able to, as I was walking from the church to meet Tommy, which was a 2 mile walk, you know, I purposely walked across the stage. You know, I think that's impactful if you can see it, but how do you do that in a virtual environment? I think it's a lot harder, and clearly there are people that are very, very good. Mm-hmm. at doing this,
right?
I'm not one of them. So I mean, know your strength and you know, give me an opportunity to speak in front of people, I will. The division contest, incidentally, was actually supposed to have been in person, and we had, I don't know, I think we had like 15 inches of snow that day, and it was canceled, and they said, okay, making a call, you know, we're going to do this virtual. And I thought, oh, great. You know, like, not, you know, I had like, you know, an hour and a half to kind of set up my mm-hmm. room to get as much body language as I could, set the camera farther away. So, I mean, I was able to accommodate that.
Yeah. It's a blessing and a curse, right? The virtual world. Everyone was able to pivot. I think my contest was supposed to be in Wausau, and so it's about 90 minutes from here. And same thing, snowstorm coming through.
Might have been the same day.
Probably was. It probably was. But so thinking about your speech, how do you go about preparing a speech that, you know, this is a polished speech as opposed to, you know, I'm going to give a speech this Friday, I'll figure something out. How do you go about preparing a polished speech like this? Are you a write everything out, or are you have some notes and kind of work through it and have it evolve as you're practicing it?
Yeah,
or something different?
Yeah, I would say it's okay for this type of speech, which I'll just broadly call a story. Mm-hmm. All right. So a story generally needs to have some sort of flow. You're building to some sort of climax. And obviously in this one, you know, you're interjecting humor as opposed to, say, a speech to inform. Mm-hmm. All right. Or a speech to inspire. So the way I'll prepare for a story is I'll just think it out in my head. Oftentimes, so I'm a runner. I'm not a good runner, but I am a runner. some of my best ideas are out on a long run, where I'll just be going through the story in my mind, and then sometimes I'll practice the speech mm-hmm. out loud mm-hmm. as I'm running.
Crazy guy out running, talking to himself.
Talking to himself. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, so. This speech kind of falls into that category. By the time I flew back from Ireland on that trip, I was already thinking there is a speech in here somewhere. Yep. I had an absolutely incredible evening at the local pub in it's a very rural area, very not a tourist area at all. And okay. just hanging out with the locals, talking to Tommy. it was crazy, you know. And so on my way home, I was already thinking, there's a speech in here. Now, I didn't know it was going to be this speech, but I was already running it through my head. All right, so then you got some kind of rough, guidelines, right? And within a couple months, I found out we were doing tall tales contests, and I thought, okay, let's just see what I can spin here.
Yeah.
Right. And yeah, so I always start with the beginning and I start with the end. You know, where do I want to leave people? Because for me, at least, if I'm putting together a story, I'm not just giving you information. I'm creating an experience for you. Mm-hmm. And what's that final, when I get you to the pinnacle, what's that experience I want you to feel? Mm-hmm. Right. So I start there, and then, you know, catchy opening. Yeah. Maybe this one wasn't so catchy, but you know, something to, in this case, I wanted to make it feel personal. Mm-hmm. Right. So I was on a trip to Ireland. Well, okay. Maybe not everybody goes to Ireland, but you've probably gone on a trip, mm-hmm. right? And so I wanted to set that stage. Oh, yeah, he's just a normal guy. He's going on vacation, right? Where's this thing going? And
right.
So that was kind of like the general framework of how I build a story type of speech.
It's almost like people who make movies. You were mentally following a story arc and plugging in the pieces. So you want to have that, like you were seeing the climax, or you were seeing the progression of the, and I think that's a really interesting way. And it's something we can all do to make our speeches better. Even informational speeches can have a story arc. So it's really helpful. So as you're going through the contest here, were there any, you know, unforeseen obstacles or challenges that you had to overcome that while you're giving your speeches? I mean, you mentioned the snowstorm, but I don't know if you want to maybe even say a little bit more, if there was something else that happened that you had to just roll with it, essentially.
Well, I mean, in my club, we had a club contest, and I know a lot of clubs don't. They just appoint somebody like, hey, who wants to go to the contest? No, we actually had a club contest, and I got second place.
Okay.
I got second place to a club member who I thought did a fantastic job. I honestly thought he had a better speech than I did. As it just so happened, you know, two members, because our area was small enough,
right?
Both of us could advance and compete at the area contest. And I was kind of surprised I won, because I thought his area speech was even better. Mm. And the same thing happened at division. And so in addition to the snowstorm situation, so sometimes you just know, right? If, mm-hmm. if you've nailed it, like, if, you know, like, oh yeah, that was good. And I can see what the other speakers do. And with a lot of experience, you kind of have a pretty good mm-hmm. idea where
right.
you did.
Right.
I did not expect to win club, area, or division. So, I mean, that was a surprise. And then, okay, so great. Now I'm at the district level. And even though I've been a member for 27 years, this is the first time I've been on the district stage. I don't consider myself that good of a speaker, at least in contests. And so I thought, okay, this is getting serious now. And I practice. So,
and that actually is a great, great segue. So tell me about, this is a unique situation within Toastmasters where you're actually giving a speech more than once. And that's fun if you like the speech, you know, if you're proud of the speech and you're happy with it, it's an opportunity to do that. So how do you practice, or how did you practice, especially once the speech was already locked in on your memory? So that for that last contest, did you have a specific plan, or was it just every day in the shower or every day out for a run, I'm just reciting it out loud?
Yeah. Yeah. No, like all of the above. So in April of that year, I joined another club. I was in two clubs, one of them folded, and I had delivered it there, as well as my, let's just call it my home club. And even before I joined the second club, I was practicing. So I gave it at least twice at my new club, multiple times at my home club. And I was actually asked on several occasions, hey, do you want to practice your speech at our club? Because I mean, after 27 years, you know, right. Let's just say I know a few people, right? And you know, people that had seen the speech and knew I would want to practice. And I actually declined them all, with the exception of the clubs that I was all already a member. And I don't know if I did myself a disservice, but I didn't want to bias any potential judges that might be there at the district level.
Interesting.
And yeah, I'm kind of funny about that. I'm, you know, having been in district leadership and knowing how important it is for fair and unbiased mm-hmm. contests, I just didn't want any hint that, oh, you know, I've seen that speech already, and
right.
Oh, man, it was so good, or I hated it, or, you know, whatever. Right.
Yeah. Was there any, for the few times that you did give it, was there any feedback that you were given that you actually incorporated, or what was some of the feedback that you received when giving your practices?
Yeah. The idea about like bending down and picking up the dirt and putting it in a pouch. That was some feedback that I had received from one of the many times I practiced. There were some suggestions for props, and in the end, I decided against it. I thought it would detract from the story.
Right.
So like I could have brought a bag, right? I could have had some dirt sitting on the stage. I suppose when Tommy offered me a nip of Ishkaba is Gaelic for whiskey. It means the water of life. So when he offered me a nip, I mean, I could have had a flask, but I thought, well, you know, while I might get a laugh or two, there were two things. One, I thought it would distract from the message, and the other thing was, I was concerned about time, because as you can imagine, how many times I practiced this speech, I was concerned about going over on time.
Yeah.
And this was especially tough when, you know, when you're kind of already pre-programmed for 5 to 7 minutes, right? Like, that's what speeches are. They're 5 to 7 minutes. Well, this one is 3 to 5.
Right.
And somebody told me it's akin to writing poetry, where you have to be like, every word has to have a purpose, has to have a meaning. Every motion, it's really got to be fine tuned.
No fluff.
No. You have to be so efficient with your words and with your motions and everything. And I thought all those other things are just distractions, and it's going to slow me down. I want to stay focused.
Right. Yeah. I was fortunate enough to give my speech to, an outside club as well. And there was somebody in that club who was, I think, somebody in senior leadership for our district. And her response was, at first I took it poorly, but it was the truth. And I, in hindsight, I really appreciate it. It was something along the lines of, your speech is really good, the delivery is great, but this isn't a speech that will win a district contest. And she kind of described what it would take for me to redo my speech. And at this point, you know, I'm so locked in. It's all, I was hesitant to even change a word in my speech for possibly throwing myself off. But I was like, you know, what do you say? But in hindsight, and in seeing who actually won the international speech contest, I'm like, yeah, that's perfectly, I mean, these people have experience. You've seen these speeches, certain types of speeches win the international speech contest. And mine was just a little bit too long in the middle and not punchy enough in some places. And so in the end, I'm still super grateful to be part of it. But
I've been asked questions like that on more than one occasion, like where I wasn't the judge, but I was at a contest, and then somebody came up to me and said, "Hey, Keith, you've been around a while. I didn't win. Like, what do you think I did wrong?" And in almost all cases, my message is, make up your mind when you're going into this. Do you have a story? Do you have a message you want to tell? Or do you want to win the contest? Because I'm not saying they're mutually exclusive, but they very well can be.
Right.
Depending on the topic that you choose, it might be a great speech. It might, like you said, everything's well constructed, well delivered, but it's not the type of speech that's going to win a contest.
Right.
So ask yourself what you want. Do you want to deliver this speech, or do you want to win?
Right.
And if you have to make the choice, then make the choice.
Right.
Don't try to think you can do both, because sometimes you can't.
Yeah. And I think that is just, the longer you're in Toastmasters and you start to see some of these things coming out, it makes you so respect the people who actually get to those higher levels.
Oh yeah.
And how perfectly crafted and honed and delivered everything is in all of those speeches. So yeah, I think watching for new members, or for all members really, just watching past speech contest winners or even participants in that and the international contest are such a learning experience. If you dissect what it is that you're seeing, it's pretty remarkable. I don't want to take too much more of your time, but let's just talk about contests maybe in general. I'm always struck, the higher you go up, the level of professionalism in Toastmaster contests. And there's a certain, and you have a kind of a inside baseball sort of a view of it all, but this feeling as going into it that I know that my chances of competing and performing well are just as good if I in Wisconsin as it were if I were living in Mexico City, or if I were in Japan, or if I were in Kenya. It's so remarkable to think that this exactness is happening everywhere in the world. So that's something I'm always impressed with. But what would you say to, you know, new members or people who have not competed on the importance of competing in some manner in Toastmasters?
Yeah, I would say the biggest, well, there's two things I generally hear with pushback about not competing. One, I'm not good enough. And to that I say, so what? No, I mean, really, like, how do you think you're going to get good?
Right.
And the other one is, well, I think I could get there, but I'm not competitive. And it doesn't really, this really doesn't interest me. So my response to that is, forget about the competition. You're in competition. You're in competition against yourself,
right?
To see how good a communicator you can be. And I've seen no better way than to compete in speech contests. If for no other reason, it's a defense mechanism. You don't want to embarrass yourself, right? Mm-hmm. So you're used to speaking in front of your club, maybe in a professional environment with people that you're, you know, familiar with. You go to the area contest. You might see a few familiar faces. You get to the division contest. Maybe you know a couple. You get to the district contest, and I don't know who any of these people are.
Right.
Right. And every time you get to the next level, you're going to get better and better because, you know, you have to, right? Mm-hmm. And unless you just have a very cavalier attitude about it, in which case I'd say, why are you in Toastmasters then if you're not that interested in becoming a more effective communicator? Forget about, I'm not good enough. I remember back to, it must have been 2010, 2011, something like that. There was a gal in my club, and she delivered a speech, just one of her, at the time they were calling them manual speeches, right? Because mm-hmm. they were mm-hmm. out of manual. And I came up to her afterwards and I said, when speech contests come around, I want to see you do that speech. I think that is a winning speech. And, do you think so? And I said, yeah, that is the kind of speech that will do well. She didn't think she was good enough. And long story short, she won the district speech contest, right? So don't sell yourself short. I mean, it's maybe some people have an overinflated sense of self-importance or an ego. Most people don't. Most people are, I think, self-conscious, especially when it comes to public speaking. Just get out there, test yourself. That's how you're going to get better.
Yeah.
And get exposed to, you get exposed to see right. the best, right?
Right. Right.
The higher the level you go.
I also love, so every time I give a speech in our club, I always feel like, I mean, or not always, but mostly I'm feeling like I could have polished it up a little bit, right? So to have something that is so polished and you've given it multiple times, I think is just a credit to your own ability to create and tell stories. It's the only time in Toastmasters where really that is possible. So I think it's a wonderful opportunity to, you know, to have your opus in terms of speech giving, and that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun mm-hmm. doing this and having the opportunity, as you say, to keep refining it and polishing it and tweaking it here and tweaking it there, and just like, what could I do a little different to, you know, to get add a little bit of excitement or zing or suspense or, you know, whatever it is you're striving for. You take the feedback and it's just this closed loop. You just keep mm-hmm. doing it over and over again. But and like you say, you deliver a speech in your club, it's probably one and done.
Right.
You know, probably, you know, unless you're practicing for a business presentation or something.
Right.
Maybe you've done it two or three times, but not, you know, 15, 20, 30, 50 times.
Right.
Practice it over and over and over again. Yeah.
Right. Well, Keith, I think with this, we'll wrap it up, but you know, you obviously have been around the Toastmasters block a few times. Why don't you, you know, do you have any final thoughts for, since I'm going to be presenting this to our club in some capacity as part of the Toastmasters project that I'm working on, what thoughts do you have for all of our five or six new members at our club in terms of the benefits of Toastmaster or where it can take you?
Yeah, I would say like a lot of things in life, you're going to get out of it what you put into it. This isn't learned by watching. This isn't learned by reading. I mean, everybody learns a little bit different. Communication, you have to do it. And there's no better place to be in a safe environment, surrounded by people that have been where you are before, and who truly want to see you improve. And it's such a nurturing environment. I didn't go into this thinking it was going to be anything that I'd still be doing in 27 years. My wife says, you know, when are you going to get enough of this? And I always say the same thing when I'm tired of learning, right? Because even after 27 years, I'm still learning.
That's a great place to end. Keith, I want to thank you for coming on the Dialogue on Dialogue podcast. And please feel free to call on me in the future if I can ever be of service to you or your club. And I sincerely hope that our paths cross again sometime soon, and maybe at another contest. So with that, we will stop the recording.